Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
I'm ready.
Jay, ready? Ooh, I guess we'll
Jay's
go
because
Jay
ready.
Said we're going to go. Hey, everybody, I'm Kyle Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense.
I'm Kimberly Adams. Thank you for joining us on this Wednesday, March the 13th. And I meant to say it earlier in the week, but forgot. Happy Ramadan to everybody getting going. Good luck with your fast if you're fasting. And so today we are going to do some news and then some smiles. So let's get to it.
All right. Let's get to
it. Go ahead.
My turn? Okay.
You have the bigger story.
Well, so this is not a story that nobody has heard of, because if you read the paper or listen to the news or watch the news, if you have to. This story is everywhere. Congress, the House today passing the bill demanding that ByteDance, the Chinese affiliate, and I don't know if it's actually Chinese, well, whatever, it's very close to China, ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, demanding that ByteDance divest of TikTok if it wants to do business in the United States. Who knows what's going to happen in the Senate? The president, through I think his spokesperson, Karine Jean-Pierre, has said the president will engage with it and may sign it. So it's got some traction if it gets through the Senate. Here's why I wanted to bring it up. I honestly can't figure out how I feel about this thing. While I absolutely understand the concerns about TikTok and the manipulation of the data and the way that the algorithm could be manipulated to, frankly, mess with people, including, you know what, as I say this out loud, this is very interesting. As I say this out loud, I'm realizing how I feel about it. I was going to say was, I don't know how I feel about it, but there's also a First Amendment thing of, look, people are grown-ups in this country and they can decide for themselves, setting aside for a minute the fact that, you know, half the people who use TikTok are like kids or whatever. So, having said all that out loud in a very non-coherent way, here's where I am now on this bill. I think it's probably a good thing, because democracy is fragile enough right now, given our domestic concerns, that the easily manipulatable hundreds-ish of millions of people in this country who use TikTok, it could do real damage. So I think I'm coming down in favor of that bill. And I brought it up because I'm curious as to what you think.
So I have a multitude of thoughts about this. But I'll latch on to your last point about, you know, sort of its ability to manipulate people. And I see it in so many different ways. So I make no secret of the fact that I'm a single person who dates. And if you consume dating content on TikTok, it very quickly sends you down some like gender wars rabbit holes. And I'm hearing more and more from friends who are dating, men, women, non-binary folks, everybody, that it's like so damaging and toxic to hear all these negative messages over and over again, like about how bad it is out there. I mean, it's not great out here, but it makes it in some ways worse. And that's just, you know, a social aspect of it. When you think about the politics component, it entrenches people more deeply into their own echo chambers and reinforces your pre-existing beliefs. And with as polarized of a country as we live in, that can be even more damaging. But, you know, you can also pop over to YouTube Shorts or Instagram Reels and get their if they could have algorithms as good as TikTok's, they would. They would love to be doing the exact same thing. And so banning TikTok is not going to fix that problem. It may just export it someplace else. What's more concerning is sort of this national security component about a company with, you know, arguable links to the Chinese government consuming that much data en masse about what the American population is thinking and doing and potentially tipping the scales, especially when it comes to politics, because you can tweak that algorithm and feed more misinformation or amplify videos that have messages that aren't true. Or when you find out that, you know, the gender wars are raging, maybe you're going to tap into that to make some, you know, political argument, or you grab data about people's viewing habits and use them to exploit, you know, someone who has security access in some ways. So I think there are a lot of risks to it. Banning or divesting the company, it's probably a safer thing from a national security perspective, but I don't know that people will be able to hear it and accept it that way. This bill passed with so much bipartisan support. And when we talked about this several months ago when the federal government was talking about, you know, banning TikTok from government devices. And we were saying how somebody has had a briefing somewhere with some really disturbing information about exactly what this app is doing on people's phones. And we've heard some of it, but not all of it. And so I generally do not like the idea of the the same thing as you, the federal government, like telling grown folks like
slippery
what
slope.
They need to be doing.
Slippery slope.
But this one does seem to be a national security concern. I do think there's a separate conversation about what these sort of social video algorithmically driven apps do to our culture. That is not going to be resolved by this.
Absolutely.
So that was really long-winded, but
look, thank you for working through that with me because it was.
I'm sort of stream of consciousness on this
too. Totally. All right, what do you got?
Bitcoin, which we haven't talked about in a while. For people who follow this, they will know Bitcoin is having quite the rally. I think it's up to $72,000 on Tuesday. Yeah. It's probably still going up. And this is a rally that has created a new batch of Bitcoin millionaires. Mm-hmm. And so all those folks who didn't sell during the crash and were the true believers, I imagine they're feeling real smug right now. And, you know, looking at that and feeling really good about staying in when a lot of people were getting out. But what's more interesting to me is how and why this is happening. Because what has helped Bitcoin recover is basically governments giving up on trying to keep Bitcoin out of the sort of more traditional financial system. And there's a story in ABC about a UK regulator giving the green light to cryptocurrency-backed investment vehicle. Obviously, the Securities and Exchange Commission approved a Bitcoin exchange-traded fund earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, the cryptocurrency industry lobbied and sued these government agencies into submission to force their way into the formal financial system. And that has lowered the barriers for entry and allowed the people who were, you know, the tech-savvy, super believers into crypto folks who stayed in to recover their losses, which is very fascinating to me.
Totally. Very interesting. $73,000 now and change, going up still.
Wow.
So, there you go.
All right. There you go. That's what I got.
There we go. Yeah, he's looking at me through the glass going, what, man?
What? Let me do it in my own time.
What? All right, you go first. Go ahead.
So this is yet another very wonky policy story, but it actually did make me smile because it shows some solutions to something that has been an issue for a while. So Republicans have very famously done this recently, but this is something that Republicans and liberals do. Republicans and Democrats do, I should say. If you have a federal policy that you don't like, right? Activist groups or, you know, think tanks and nonprofits or whatever will often sue the government or sue the agency saying, this is unconstitutional, this violates my rights, right? That's how you often change policy through the courts. What typically happens is these groups that go around trying to overturn policy will choose to file their cases in places where they think that case will end up before a judge that is sympathetic to their cause. So, for example, if you're trying to overturn the FDA's ability to send out abortion pills in the mail, maybe you will choose to make the plaintiffs in your lawsuit be in Texas, where you think that you're going to end up in front of a federal judge that's going to rule in your favor. And then when you're appealing and things like that, it goes up a pathway of friendly judges. And this is something that liberals and conservatives have done for a long time. Well, now the federal judges themselves, I'm going to read from Politico here, have moved to crack down on that tactic by adopting a new policy that mandates that all federal suits aimed at invalidating a national policy or statute or state law or executive order be randomly assigned among judges throughout the judicial district where the case is filed. The change means that challenges to state or federal government policies or laws filed in any of the nation's 94 federal judicial districts will be subject to random assignment among all judges accepting civil cases in those districts, rather than being retained in the particular geographic division where they are filed and assigned only to the judge or judges in that division. And the judges themselves got together and made this happen. This is the Judicial Conference of the United States, which sets policies for the federal judiciary. And they basically got together and said, we're going to end judge shopping for these groups that are trying to overturn federal policy. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a huge, huge deal. There is one district court judge in like West Texas. He's the only judge in that district. And he's the guy who ruled on
Judge Matthew Kaczmarek in Amarillo.
Right. And he's the guy who, after having been judge shopped, invalidated Mifepristone.
The FDA approved it.
Right, right.
Exactly.
Which, and so it's super interesting to me that the judges actually did this by themselves because they recognize what a threat it is to their perception, right, by the American public upon which their entire credibility lasts. I'm glad you brought that up. Totally interesting. Totally interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was really fascinating. Yeah. And Politico is the only one I saw even covering this. Yeah. I was like, ooh, this is a big deal.
Yeah, very big deal.
All right, what's your smile?
Mine is not so much a make me smile as a make me LOL. those of you who follow media at all will know that Don Lemon got fired from CNN last year-ish at some point for a whole lot of reasons, not the least of which was saying on national television that Nikki Haley was past her prime. He then, a month or so ago, maybe a little more, announced that he had made a deal with Elon Musk to stream a new show on Twitter. And yes, I still call it Twitter. And so the other day, he apparently taped an interview with Musk to air on the first day of that show on Twitter called The Don Lemon Show, set to start streaming Monday. Apparently, Musk didn't like the way the interview went and has now canceled the entire deal with Don Lemon.
And this is what happens when billionaires control the media.
Who didn't see this coming? Right? That's, I mean, yours is a much better point. Mine is, you freaking moron, how did you not see this coming? Yours is, billionaires have too much power. Anyway.
And soul control,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, you have billionaire owners of other news organizations, and I'm using news organizations here broadly since I'm guessing he was trying to do a news or journalistic show on the platform.
Right.
But, you know, if Jeff Bezos wakes up tomorrow and decides that the Washington Post should no longer have a firewall between what he wants and what the paper reports, there's not much anybody can do about it.
You betcha.
You know, gentle plug here for our fundraising drive that we're in. So that we don't have to rely on billionaires to do the news, please.
Oh, my God. The link will be on the show page, marketplace.org/givesmart.
Yes.
Nicely done.
No, but I mean, it's real. That's
totally.
You know, you and I have different career paths that we could have taken, and we are in public radio for a reason.
Yep.
Because at the end of the day, we know that's not going to happen to us because we're not accountable to a billionaire for what we cover or what we choose to talk about. And not everybody has that freedom, and we're very lucky.
Yep, absolutely right. Marketplace.org/givesmart. Send us your money,
yes.
Please.
Please and thank you.
Done today. Back tomorrow. Until then, you know how to do it. Thoughts, questions, comments, or actually audio that you think we ought to talk about on the Thursday show.
Mm-hmm.
MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org, or you can leave us a voicemail, 508-UBSMART.
Jay is so impatient with that theme. Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Today's program was engineered by the ever-impatient Jay Siebold. Talia Menchaca is our intern.
Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer is Marissa Cabrera. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcast. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.